Good morning. This is Dee with the Vermilion County News for March 20th, 2017. We'll begin our reading today with the article entitled Budget Cuts Deep into Rural America by Carrie Murakami out of Washington. Voters from small town and rural America who were key to electing President Donald Trump stand to lose the most in his budget plan to shrink the size and generosity of the federal government. Advocates for rural residents said the president's spending blueprint adversely impacts a range of programs helpful to less populated regions, including those to prevent homelessness, help the poor pay heating bills, provide community loans, fund training for nurses, assist farmers, and preserve clean waterways. These and other stark domestic program cuts to government agencies are needed to pay for the president's plan to spend untold billions of dollars expanding the military and securing the nation's border with Mexico to curtail illegal immigration, said Mick Mulvaney, White House budget director. Congressman Dave Lebsack, Democrat from Iowa, decried the president's budget for sacrificing rural assistance programs to shift spending to the Department of Defense and the Department of Homeland Security. The president's budget makes it clear he never intended to keep his promises to rural Iowa and America, said Lebsack. This budget slashes investments in programs that help Iowa's small towns and rural communities. Lebsack and other critics noted the president's plan is subject to change by Congress and that they will fight the cuts to programs for improving the economic lot of rural residents and communities. West Virginia, which voted overwhelmingly for Trump, discovered his budget proposes eliminating the Appalachian Regional Commission, an agency that helps distraught communities in that state get back on their feet. Republican Senator Shelley Moore, Capito of West Virginia, issued a statement saying the commission is essential to redeveloping economically distressed regions of West Virginia, especially the coal communities that have been devastated by years of regulatory overreach. John Newton, a director for the American Farm Bureau, said farmers and ranchers are already struggling to make a living, and now is not the time to make even deeper cuts to such services as to statistics on crop prices and the number of local U.S. Department of Agricultural offices. Every farmer in the U.S. goes to those USDA offices, said Newton. They file required reports on planting there and get help with applying for grants and doing conservation. Senator John Hoeven, Republican of North Dakota, chairman of the Senate Agricultural Appropriations Subcommittee, said in a statement, Trump's proposal to reduce federal agricultural programs by $4.7 billion does not work and cannot be justified. Sarah Mickelson, public policy director for the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, said eliminating millions of dollars for projects related to affordable housing and homelessness will hurt rural communities as well as urban areas. In small towns, she added, many people live in substandard homes or can't. The National Resources Defense Council pointed out that the president's budget eliminates a fund that gives rural governments and nonprofits money to clean up drinking water systems and improve sewage disposal to avoid disasters such as what happened in Flint, Michigan. I don't think voters wanted this, Laura Bryan, a water quality expert for the environmental group, wrote in a blog post. The Trump administration's $6.2 billion, or 13%, cut to the Department of Housing and Urban Development would be the biggest hit that agency has taken since President Ronald Reagan slashed it in the early 1980s, said the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. Those cuts ushered in a new age of homelessness, with a dramatic increase in the number of people sleeping on the streets, in cars, and in shelters, the group's president, Diane Yentl, said in a statement. The USDA cuts could also mean the loss of staff that helps property owners keep homes in rural regions rentable, she said. Preserving low-income rentals is critical, Yentl added, because there hasn't been an increase in funding new homes in rural areas since 20. Maggie Elawani, Vice President for Government Affairs at the National Rural Health Association, said her group is concerned about Trump's proposed $403 million cut to the National Institutes of Health program to train nurses and other medical workers, many of whom work in rural America. She said the budget also includes unspecified cuts to a range of rural health programs that fund research, telehealth, geriatric programs, and hospital grants at a time when there are 80 fewer rural hospitals since 2010. Mulvaney, the White House budget director, and a conservative former GOP congressman from South Carolina, said the budget represents a president who is beholden to nobody but the voters and is following through on his promise to, quote, drain the swamp in Washington of wasteful, duplicative programs that simply don't work. The president's budget deals only with the government's discretionary spending and does not include the more costly entitlement programs such as Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. They make up the largest portion of the $4 trillion annual federal budget. Now we'll turn to an article about the Danville Symphony Orchestra, entitled A Golden Group. Community support has kept the music flowing for 50 years, by Melissa Merrily, out of Danville. Barbara Headland of Urbana performs as principal cellist in four ensembles, among them the Danville Symphony Orchestra. She's been with it since 1994, and is impressed, but not surprised, that Danville has been able to sustain an orchestra for 50 years. There's a very dedicated board and supporters, she said. The community has rallied to support the orchestra. The mayor, Scott Eisenhower, got up on stage last weekend and made a proclamation for the orchestra's 50th anniversary. Maestro Jeremy Swirling, who has led the orchestra from 1990 to 93 and 1999 to now, said the orchestra has survived because its audience appreciates the entertainment value of it and the beauty and grandeur of the symphony. The last 25 years, the symphony has focused on diverse programming, he said. It was mostly classical before 1990. We really balanced and varied our programs, and the amount of talent we've brought to town is unprecedented. Among soloists who have appeared with the orchestra over the years are trumpeter Doc Severinsen, cellist Yo-Yo Ma, and the Von Trapp children. Considering the current climate for the arts, Headland tips her hat to Danville residents who have kept the orchestra going for a half century. Among them are Lou and Sybil Mervis. Sybil Mervis recently dug into archives and was surprised to discover that her husband had gone to bat early on for the formation of an orchestra in Danville. But if not for Gail and Harry Adams, the Danville Symphony wouldn't exist, she said. Gail and Harry Adams, who taught music at Danville Junior College, had begun talking in the summer of 1967 about an orchestra for the city. They began to make a list of musicians in the area who might be interested. The count was close to 30, not yet enough, but the idea was contagious, reads the history of the orchestra. Adams met with the then Danville Junior College president, Mary Miller, and convinced her the community needed an orchestra. Lou Mervis met with the college board of trustees to lobby for an orchestra. Miller's reply, "I will see to it that we have an orchestra." She also agreed to have the college provide rehearsal space, buy music stands, a set of timpani, and a bassoon, and to give college credit to students who participated. In the beginning, there was little money, and the players were not paid. The money that was needed had to be borrowed or begged. Gail and Harry Adams, the orchestra's founders, helped by taking on the duties of the orchestra stage manager, librarian, and personnel manager, by writing press releases and program notes, and by leading the fundraising. Small contributions from friends, donations in kind from businesses, and an angel, who happened just when the financial picture looked bleakest, kept the orchestra afloat, reads the orchestra history. Finally, the Danville Junior College Symphony debuted in December 1967 in the Danville High Auditorium with 53 players. Among them were a photographer, a land surveyor, several businessmen, a Danville Junior College instructor, a secretary, a newspaper man, music teachers, housewives, and students. They played two concerts that first season. The orchestra then worked to increase the number of players. Over its second season, the orchestra presented two concerts again, and by the third season, it had an advisory board of early supporters, among them J.K. Holmes, Charles Handley, Dr. William Schaffer, and Sybil Mervis. Financial backing continued to come from the junior college and from the city of Danville through a Parks and Recreation Fund. The orchestra also received money from the Music Performance Trust Fund of the American Federation of Musicians and the Illinois Arts Council, and submitted its first grant application to the National Endowment for the Arts. As the financial base grew, the orchestra brought in more players and began paying them, expanded its season, and hired professional solos. It was pretty much avocational players in the early years, and then it switched over to undergraduates, graduate students, and more experienced professionals from around the area, Swirling said. As the support grew, we were able to do more of that. Now the orchestra is really on par with our neighboring professional colleagues in Champaign-Urbana and Lafayette and Terre Haute in Urbana, in Indiana, he said. The orchestra now fields from 40 to 60 musicians, sometimes more, depending on their repertoire. They come from Indianapolis, Chicago, Champaign-Urbana, Danville, and other cities. The orchestra presents four concerts each season, splitting them between pops and classical music, and a nutcracker bringing in ballet companies from Indianapolis or Chicago to perform. Like any professional orchestra or arts group, the Danville Symphony struggles to support itself, particularly in this anti-arts climate. One of the points we're trying to get across to the community is only 30% of operating costs come from ticket sales, said Ryan Lockhull, executive director of the Danville Symphony. The rest is fundraising, private support, grants, and donations. Joyce DeBeer, the orchestra board president, said the orchestra's survival over 50 years is a testament to the community's commitment to music and quality of life. And she said the orchestra provides a lot that isn't mentioned much. She cited the children's concerts, which the orchestra has offered to county fourth and fifth graders for at least 30 years. Swirling makes those educational, telling the students about the instruments and what they will hear. For most, it's the first time they hear a symphony orchestra live. He also provides education for adults in the community through Minutes with the Maestro. DeBeer said, at our last concert, the symphony was able to bring in two pianists who did four-handed piano music. Jeremy and Eric Simonson, a music teacher at Danville Area Community College, talked about the music and why it was that way. It was very interesting. With Danville Area Community College, the orchestra also takes classics in the classroom to Danville High, teaching advanced history students the evolution of music from Europe to America today. And with the help of Lou and Sybil Mervis, the orchestra was able to bring to Danville for engagement events over 4 years the Veronica String Quartet and Zora String Quartet when both were in residence at Indiana University. They're great musicians who like to teach, share their knowledge, and enthusiasm for music. DeBeer called the symphony an inexpensive adventure in music. Hedlund pointed out that the orchestra is a value to the community as well. The arts stimulate a lot of businesses, she said. Every time you do a concert, 35 businesses are involved. The sponsors, the people who print the programs, all the tech people who work behind the scenes. An orchestra stimulates the economy and makes the community worth living in. To keep itself going, the orchestra board established an endowment, now at more than $850,000, an amount that Swirling said is likely unprecedented for an orchestra of its size and a city of Danville's population of 35,253. We have planned giving commitments for considerably more than that as well, she said. He said, there's been a very generous generation of audience members in town, but they are not being replaced by enough new people, because Danville is not growing, and that really threatens the long-term interests of all of the arts in Danville. So I'm really hopeful the city and the state can finally resolve some of its major issues and break through some of the heavy resistance that's been around for progress. And now we'll turn to a sports article. The NJCAA tournament bounces into Mary Miller Gymnasium by Jennifer Bailey, Danville. The Mary Miller Gymnasium soon will be taken over by the fast action sights and sounds of the National Junior College Athletic Association Men's Division II National Basketball Tournament. Danville Area Community College Athletic Director Tim Bunton said Danville is known all around, from college athletes and coaches, basketball fans and officials, for putting on a great tournament. He will talk to other athletes in other states who say they know Danville and are trying to get there to play in the tournament. That's a real neat thing. It's known all over, Bunton said. Mayor Scott Eisenhower said some people he also talks to look forward to spending their spring break in, of all places, Danville, because they want to support their team in the tournament. This year's tournament will bring another estimated 12 to 15,000 people here for the tournament at DAC on March 21st to the 25th. There are some slight time changes on games this year. There was an overhaul with the brackets, so that means 6 games on Tuesday, 5 each on Wednesday and Thursday, 6 on Friday and 4 on Saturday. All 4 quarterfinal games will be on Thursday. The 2 semifinal games will be on Friday and the championship game still on Saturday. This is the 32nd year for the NJCAA Division II Men's National Basketball Tournament and 24th year Danville has hosted it. DAC will serve as host of 16 teams. Bunton has been helping tournament director Dick Shockey and working with others on the tournament for about 22 years. Bunton started as baseball coach at DAC, in which he remains as coach, in the fall of 1995. He became athletic director about 10 years ago. Bunton helps with the bench. He helps run the shot clock, score book, and as a stats keeper for the week's games. He also helps with the visiting officials. The 18 officials come in from all over, Bunton said, about the officials coming from Nebraska, Tennessee, Kentucky, and other states, but mostly from the Midwest. The officials have hotel assignments, and Bunton said he helps with their tax forms. It's a fun week with them. You get to know them. They love to be here. Bunton said the week is a busy one during the tournament, but a lot of fun. He said his baseball players don't see him a lot that week, but I wouldn't want it another way. When it's tournament time every year, DAC of softball coaches Matt and Kelly Cervantes lose their office for the week for it to become a tournament office. Bunton said he's turned his office over to newspaper reporters and others as needed. Other DAC athletes also have helped over the years with the tournament, such as with concessions or helping clean up and in other areas as needed. Bunton said he really enjoys seeing students from Vermilion County schools come and watch the games. This year, however, the tournament falls during fall break for area schools. Gym can get really loud when they're here. He said one team threw candy to the students to make them cheer for their team. It's always better when DAC's in it, Bunton said, smiling about the tournament. It's pretty special. Bunton said DAC head basketball coach DeJuan Guard does a great job. It's such a tough league, Bunton said. DAC next year, March 9th through the 11th, will host the Region 24 tournament that determines who makes the national. Tournament organizers love to see returning and new basketball fans, and people come to the tournament every year. You can see it in the play, Bunton said. Even if a team loses, they're guaranteed 2 games. The players are also seen by 4-year college representatives. Burton and Shockey said the volunteers are to be credited for running a great tournament year after year. The way Shockey has run it, second to none. It's all about the kids first and foremost, adding that it's Shockey's mantra. Eisenhower said impacts on the city from the tournament include the economic impact and the pride people take in the city as a host of the tournament. Now we will turn to the obituaries. The first is for Larry Dean Collum, 84, who died at his home in rural Georgetown early Friday morning, March 17, 2017. A celebration of Larry's life will be held at 10 a.m. Tuesday, March 21st, at Sunset Houghton Leisure Funeral Home, 200 East West Street, Georgetown. He will be laid to rest at Whitlock Cemetery. Visitation will be 4 to 8 p.m. Monday, March 20th, at the funeral home. Betty E. Conaway, 83, of Tilton, went to the Lord at 8:02 p.m. March 15th, 2017, at Presence USMC in Danville. Funeral services, 11 a.m. Monday, March 20th, at Robeson Chapel in Catlin, with Ramona Logan officiating. Burial in Davis Cemetery in Fairmount. Visitation is from 10 to 11 a.m., 1 hour prior to the services, at Robeson Chapel in Catlin. Terry Jean Wright, 66, of Westville, passed away Thursday, March 16, 2017, at 11 p.m. at the VA Ileana Healthcare Systems in Danville. A celebration of Terry's life will be held at 1 p.m. Wednesday, March 22nd, at Sunset Urbis Funeral Chapel, 414 South State Street, Westville. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. prior to services at the funeral home. Clifford Spud Kincaid. Visitation will be Sunday, March 19th from 2 to 4 p.m. at Post Road Christian Church, 1112 North Post Road, Indianapolis, Indiana. Services will be at the church on Monday, March 20th at 10. Burial will be 3 p.m. Monday in West Lebanon Cemetery. Julia Wise. A celebration of Julia's life will be held at 11 a.m. on April 1st at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Danville. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. prior to the service. Millard E. Watts died at 1:01 p.m. on Wednesday, March 15, 2017, at his residence. Funeral services will be conducted at 2 p.m. on Monday, March 20th, in the Elmwood Chapel of the Day and Carter Mortuary of Bedford, Indiana. Burial will follow in the Greenhill Cemetery. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. until the hour of service, with the Eagles Memorial Service starting at 1 p.m. Willie Hall. Willie B. Hall, 91, of Danville, died at 2:57 p.m. Thursday, March 16th, at Presence United Samaritans Medical Center, Danville. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Leek and Sons Funeral Home in Danville. Artis Schwartz, 56, of Sheldon, died at 8:12 a.m. Thursday at home. Cremation rites will be accorded, and a memorial service will be held at a later date. Bobby Stringfellow, 83, of Danville, died at 11:55 a.m. Sunday, March 19th, at home. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Leek & Sons Funeral Home of Danville. Bert Kirby, 75, of Fairmount, died at 3:53 a.m. Saturday, March 18th, at Presence United Samaritans Medical Center, Danville. A private graveside service will be held at Danville National Cemetery, Danville. Okay, now we'll go back to some local news of the 40th All-Area Girls Basketball. Anya Peoples, Player of the Year, more hills to climb. Always improving sophomore continues to aim for the top, by Anthony Zills. 93 students attend Schlarum Academy, a Catholic school built at the highest point in Danville around what was once the mansion of W.G. Hartshorn, an owner of the electric coal company in town. Three of those students will likely play women's Division I basketball, a number that was larger before Duke commit Ariel Scott left the Hilltoppers and transferred to Urbana last summer. One of those students is Anya Peoples, a jovial sophomore with a bright smile. The 5'10" point guard happens to be one of the top girls basketball players in the country, too, in her class. Peoples has 30 Division I offers, the first of which came the summer before 8th grade. ESPN ranks her 16th in the class of 2019. Prospective Nation puts her 3rd. She was one of 4 sophomores named to the 50-player preseason Naismith Award watch list for National Player of the Year. "I think she's going to be a program changer, to be honest with you," said Stephanie Roach, Peoples coach at Indianapolis-based AAU team Best Choice. "Every time I see this kid on the floor, she gets better." While basketball has expanded her world, life at a tiny school is all Peoples knows. She's gone to Schlarm since preschool. All of her classes are within a few hundred yards, between which she walks through the mansion and up the stairs to her tidy locker. Several of her basketball teammates have also gone to Schlarm for years, including fellow Division I recruit Capria Brown, a freshman. "I love knowing everybody and seeing everybody in the hall," said Peoples, who has 23 classmates in her graduating class. "We're all like a family here." During her sophomore season, Peoples led a team entirely made of freshmen and sophomores to a 21-6 record by averaging 15.6 points, 5.6 rebounds, 4.7 steals, and 4.1 assists per game on her way to the News Gazette Player of the Year honors. And while her basketball career has taken Peoples across the country, Schlarm has incubated her talents for most of her life. Keith Peoples had no grand plan when he took 6-year-old Anya to Shebby Gymnasium at Schlarm once a week during practices for the Hilltoppers girls basketball team, then coached by Anya's mother, Tricia Peoples. "Personally speaking, it was just a matter of me carving out time within my day to spend time with my daughter, to develop a stronger relationship with her at a very young age," said Keith Peoples, who played at Sam Houston State in the mid-1990s. "We had a routine that every Friday I would pick her up and we would walk over to the gymnasium. We would spend about 45 minutes just laughing and talking about her day, shooting baskets, and she would look forward to it every Friday. Then afterwards we would get ice cream." By second grade, though, he noticed his daughter had uncommon skills. Not only did she find joy playing basketball that she didn't when her parents took her to a few dance and gymnastics practices, but she had hand-eye coordination and spatial awareness rare for a 7-year-old. Keith Peoples researched club teams and called Indianapolis Best Choice, asking Roach if it would be possible for his second-grade daughter to play on a team with mostly fourth graders. "The program director stated to me, 'We may want to wait a while because the kids we have on our team don't double dribble and they don't travel with the ball,'" said Peoples. "She just may not be up to par. We may want to give it some time. We were cut before we had a chance to try out." "It was a complete misjudgment. I can understand the comment, but she knew how to play the game. We had fun, we spent time together, but we focused on the fundamentals and the roles of the game." Keith Peoples did call back the next year, and Roach invited Anya to a tournament. She'd play in a game, and they'd see how she fit. It went well, so well that she joined the team and never left. She could dribble, she could pass, she didn't travel with the ball. "One thing I really remember is her running full speed and catching the ball in stride, taking one or two dribbles and then make a layup. That's pretty impressive for a third grader." By the time she was in the 7th grade, she was playing on the Best Choice high school team, and that's when her recruiting took off. On the floor, Peoples looks like a polished player. Her game isn't solely built on speed and athleticism, but on skill and basketball intelligence. She's a humble kid and a great teammate, and she's very unselfish when it comes to playing the game of basketball. This has been Dee reading the Vermilion County News for March 20th. I look forward to reading with you again soon. Have a great day.